Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori.
And today we are talking about we've gotten the question a lot about, you know, I have this person in my life, I have this child in my life that I'm concerned about. How do I show up for that person?
We love that question, by the way.
We do love that question because it means that you're actively listening. It also means that you actively recognize that you, even though you may not know what to do, you want to figure out what to do. And we just had this conversation today actually with somebody about how many people have said, I believed in my story, you know, I believed her, but I didn't know what to do. Find out what to do, right?
Well, I was just thinking, like, the question, like, we want to know how to help a child better, also acknowledges that the ownership is on the adults to figure out how to help a child, not on the child to figure out how to somehow tell and how, whatever. It's on the grownups.
Yeah. I mean, that's true across the board, even just in survivors in general, right? Is that as the people providing the support, the onus should always be on the people providing the support to the survivor, not on the survivor to do it right. Because that whole concept of doing it right as a survivor just reinforces all of the trauma that they've already experienced. So today we want to talk about what can people do to show up for a child or for a teen that they're concerned about. And also, what do CSEC survivors need? So Lori, what does CSEC mean?
It stands for Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children.
Yeah. Which is awful that there's an acronym for it, but there is indeed.
Yes, there is.
So I guess let's start with why telling about this type of abuse. I mean, any type of abuse is hard to tell. But why is it so hard to talk about or to tell about this specific type of abuse?
Well, I think we have to maybe break that down a little bit into two sections. So child sexual exploitation, you know, there is that the branch of it, if you will, that is teens that have ended up kind of getting caught up in things, teens and young adults that are caught up in things, whether it's a boyfriend or they're aging out of foster care or they ran away, whatever that is. And there is so much shame that is entangled in that for the teen that there can often be a feeling of, I could never go back. They're told repeatedly, they'll never accept you back after everything that you've done. Like, there's so much that has been brainwashed into them to make them feel like there is no returning to a better life. There are a lot of reasons why those kinds of kids get trapped. But really, mostly what we're talking about here is what is it that keeps a family-controlled trafficking child so stuck?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more out there about teens and tweens that are stuck in a trafficking situation, and not very much about family-controlled kids and why they're so stuck.
Right. The basics, though, still go back to the grooming process. I think that the grooming process, at least from my perspective as a survivor, definitely is more intense and definitely is more consistent because it was family-based trafficking. And so, you know, my traffickers literally were my parents. And so there was a 24/7 kind of access to my brain, to my body, to my, you know, whole self, where grooming could take place literally on a daily basis. So I think that the grooming process for family-based trafficking survivors is intensified by 1,000. But the basic of it is still a grooming process.
Absolutely. Yes. So let's not, we don't want to make it too complicated. We don't want to oversimplify it, right?
Right.
So first, let's just say that grooming represents all the ways that a perpetrator prepares a child or teen for the abuse that they intend to perpetrate. It's all the ways that they lay the foundation for the child being trapped, all the ways that they keep a child trapped, that they get them accustomed to the terrible things that are about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about what kinds of things go into the grooming process. So one piece of that is just even having access and isolating a child from anyone who would help them. Right. And that isolation can come in the form of literally keeping a child away from any other adult. Often traffickers, perpetrators who are the caregiver will not allow a child to be one-on-one with another adult, not with a medical professional. They don't let the child kind of go to friends' houses and have access to the parents of their friends. They set up the child's life so that the child does not have access to the potential of another caring adult.
Right.
There is also a process of sort of convincing the child that there's some kind of special relationship that exists between the offender and the child, that there's something between us that other people wouldn't understand, so you can't talk about it. This is special between us. And honestly, often these children are, I mean, all children, frankly, who doesn't want to believe that you matter to someone? We all do, and children certainly do, and these children are clearly in familial trafficking situations, they're in very unhealthy families where they are left feeling emotionally starved. So when someone comes along and says, you matter to me, you're special to me, and this is just something that we do, it's not a hard leap for a kid to not want the bad things to happen. Of course, let's all be very clear. There is nothing in abuse, there's nothing in sexual abuse that is something that a child wants. But it is not crazy for a child to want attention,
yep,
and to be special. So another aspect of the grooming process is desensitizing a child to touch and talking about sexual things, like bringing sexuality of any kind into an adult-child interaction or relationship. It's they dip their toe in the water slowly and get the child accustomed to the idea that sexuality is something that exists in a child caregiver relationship, which is, again, disgusting for us to think about. But most offenders do not just jump in with sexual assault. They begin by, again, grooming is exactly that. They begin by getting a child slowly desensitized to it so that they won't be quite so shocked when the ultimate thing happens.
Yeah. I guess how I see the grooming process looking back. So my memories go back, honestly, as early as 4 years old. But even by then, my memories at 4 years old was that I understood that my father and I had a, you know, quote, special relationship. I understood that my grandfather was harsh and to not upset him. And that I understood that my uncle was just like gross and skeevy and you never really knew what to expect. But I already had that knowledge base, I guess, by the age of four, because my memories at the age of four are already of that. So,
okay. But I want us to make sure that we stop and really hold that image in our mind of the fact that we know how tiny 4-year-olds are. Mm-hmm. We know how little they can actually do for themselves, how little they can articulate their experience. And that's even the healthiest 4-year-old. But what about a 4-year-old who also has never been given power and voice throughout? So I just want to make sure that we don't glance over that too quickly.
Right. No.
Okay. If you hear any sounds in my microphone, that's because Silas decided
obviously
to snort
Silas
into my microphone.
He's also smelling the microphone.
Oh. Kate likes to smell the microphone for reasons
we
don't
like
understand.
To. It's just that it takes me by
necessary.
Surprise each
okay.
time that we do it. The abuse, and especially the pictures that were taken, it kind of unfolded somewhat slowly at first. I have memories of kind of like, now you're ready for this type of things. And when I was...
Which, did that feel like, congratulations, you've been promoted? Is that how they made it feel?
Mm-hmm. No, it was more like a sinister, like, ugh, you're ready, you know? And I have that word ready. It's so triggering to me and it's so burned into my brain, I guess, of like, that's not, it's I don't want to be ready. Because being ready meant that it would escalate. And so that trend of kind of preparing and escalating would, it just continued. And so they would, like you said, the desensitization, they would prepare, right? And it was this really with my dad and my grandfather, my uncle, preparing my body and my mind for what was to come with a buyer.
So there was essentially practicing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's terrible.
And then there was also the conditioning not to tell, which I think this is what I was trying to get at in the beginning, was saying that the grooming was so intense, because it was like legitimately brainwashing of, we do not tell. And again, from the very, very, very beginning, even my memories as early as 4, 5, 6 years old, I knew not to tell.
Not to tell, but also to not let on that anything was not okay.
Oh God. Yeah. Like not even just right. Not even just don't explicitly tell, but you do well in school. You do well in your extracurriculars. You do all the things.
You're well behaved. Yes. You're not anything that would stand out.
No, absolutely. Because anything that stands out is then concerning for someone's going to notice, someone's going to ask questions. And that was just a known thing. Like I said, I mean, as early as those really early years, I knew that, you know,
which makes it so astounding that there were still times when you said something or in some way indicated that things were not okay because you were so terrified. So the fact that you were brave enough or desperate enough, so even sometimes, to indicate that there was something going wrong, and then for that expression of need to be ignored is just,
yeah,
unspeakably awful.
I have memories of being told it's okay repeatedly. I say that a lot. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm reminding myself that it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Again, that's part of the brainwashing, really, is just implanting that, like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay.
Which I have found, honestly, as a therapist, that it is difficult sometimes because there are trigger words like that that are words that that's a phrase I would use regularly, that is clearly problematic and hard to eliminate from your language. But being attuned, that's also part of that attunement. Like, are you paying attention to how the survivor around you reacts, mm-hmm, in certain situations to try to not be triggery?
Yep. And then, you know, as things got worse and they progressed, the message became clearer. The more that I understood and the older I got, the message would then follow suit. So when I was older, it would be, you'll be in trouble if you tell, you know, and they would list all the horrible things that would happen if I was in trouble. And I already knew what some of those looked like, because being in trouble with them, with the dark world people, was quite different than just like a kid being in trouble, right?
You're not getting grounded.
Right. My kids get in trouble all the time. And like, that's not what I'm talking about. Right. So there was that. They would, you know, you'll be in trouble if you tell. Everyone will hate you. So especially in those like tween years, right? When it's like your self-image and all of the confidence problems and the weird middle school stuff. And now the message is everyone will hate you. Do you want people to know all these disgusting things that you've been doing? Do you like what you've been doing? Do you want people to hear that and see that? So then that was drilled in, right? Later it was, our family will be homeless because of you. We'll lose everything. You'll be sleeping on the streets. You'll be homeless. You won't have a family anymore.
I feel like that one was used when you were young too.
Yeah. 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 Because I was so afraid of being outside at night. And I feel like that was, yeah. Anyway, we're not going to unpack that right now.
Okay. But can I just comment? Because I think people who are hearing you say, you know, they were brainwashing you to think, do you really want people to know about the terrible things you've been doing? Even though, mm-hmm, they were making you do these things, their message to you repeatedly was as if you were choosing to do these things. And that circle, mm-hmm, is so crazy making.
Okay, as like an aside, we might want to cut this, but that circle, that merry-go-round, is continues through the support or lack thereof, even now, mm-hmm, as a survivor trying to get out, trying to disconnect, trying to heal. We keep finding that the onus is still on me as a survivor to do it right, to say it right. We've talked about this ad nauseum, right? To have the right public facing self, to be able to tell the story articulately, to be able to file the police report and go to the hospital. The onus is still on the victim to do it right in order to get help. So it's that whole cycle. The services that are available are still putting you in that cycle, right? Of
tell us what you need is right.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, okay, so let's talk about this, right? We just recently, we've talked about Grace, the organization that was hired by Cornerstone Church on Grand Island to come in and do a private investigation, or independent investigation, even though, you know, their payer source, $70,000, was coming from the church, the very church where the abuse happened, and many of the abusers still sit in their pews. Awesome. We go back, listen to our episodes about Grace, and just what an absolute nightmare that was.
I think that one is Why Is This So Difficult Part 2.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That's the episode.
So at the end of all of that, the conclusion of that was Grace has messed it up so many times. This was way out of their league.
Information was being leaked to people who are now heckling us.
Yes, literally.
And knowing information that they had no business knowing, which just made it, that was the final straw of these are, it's not safe to stay engaged.
Absolutely not. No, they're literally leaking information. The church is then leaking it to offenders. I mean, it was just getting to a place where it's truly just not safe. So we made the decision with the support and the help of my attorney to basically say to Grace, we are not giving permission to use any of the information that I've shared. I mean, we had shared explicit details, many, many disclosures of abuse, names and places. I mean, hours upon hours of energy went into
trying hard for this to actually be something that could move the process forward.
Right. That could be so helpful.
Hard. Right. So we tried. We really tried.
Yeah. I mean, we gave them, you know, so much information, so much corroboration, medical records and police reports.
Corroborating statements.
Yeah. People who gave corroborating statements, and they just continued to drop the ball and make it unsafe. And they were not listening. It was like talking to I have said this so many times, I can't even believe I've said it again, but it's like slamming your face into a brick wall, expecting it to move. And so we finally said, okay, we revoke all of that, right? That's my personal information that I shared with you. I had the right to share it or not share it. And now I'm taking it all back.
That was like maybe January?
Yeah. So they said, okay, well, we will have to consult with the church and let them know, because again, they call themselves neutral, but the church is ultimately the payer source, right? So I don't really know how you can be neutral in that. But they, you know, consulted with the church. We emailed, and then it was like no contact. We didn't hear from them for a long time. And we finally, Lori.
So we emailed the pastor of Cornerstone, essentially outlining what the concerns were for how they were going to close out their investigation and begging that they would be mindful of Kate's safety in that process. We sent the same thing to Grace. We then, because we got no response, started sending it to Grace's board members. No response.
Grace's founder.
Right. No response from anyone. None. Not even a thanks for letting us know. We're aware. We're on it. No, absolutely no response. Until, what do you know, today?
Right. So we reached out to Emily, the one lead investigator. We said, you know, what is going on, right? Have you decided to continue your investigation without my, which I think would be interesting if they had, because again, they're investigating my stuff, my story, my life, my abuse without any information from me because I revoked it all. Anyway, she basically said, thanks for reaching out. We have informed Cornerstone leadership that you have revoked consent of the use of information provided in this investigation, and that this decision has effectively limited our ability to complete a thorough investigation. Cornerstone then decided to terminate the contract with Grace. But my point in sharing this right now in this moment is that once again, the onus is put back on me. What Emily is saying here is because you, as the survivor, didn't do it right, because you wouldn't let us use the information, even though we dropped the ball and dropped the ball and dropped the ball and ultimately leaked your information to the wrong people, The onus is still on you because you pulled it back from us.
There's no ownership in that of because we failed to understand the enormity of what we're getting into and then we couldn't handle the enormity of this whole thing, we realize that this can't go on.
Right.
There's none of that.
Right.
It's just you pulled your stuff back, so now.
Right. So that circle, that merry-go-round of just the onus continues to be on the survivor, that continues even into recovery, right? And that is where it gets so messy.
And current day. I mean, some people have said, you know, gee, you know, that this all of the early stuff for Kate was so many years ago. Maybe it's different now. I don't think so.
No, it's obviously not. But that
not different enough.
Right. But that conditioning, that runs deep because honestly, a year ago, had we gotten that email from Emily, I would have been like, it's my fault. It's my fault that all of this happened. It's my fault that they couldn't help. It's my fault because that's the conditioning. The abusers used the same conditioning that now peripheral people or enablers, I guess that's really the term for it, enablers are using, which is to kind of keep putting the onus. It's your fault that you can't get help. It's your fault that this is happening to you. So the conditioning is deep when you're talking about kids trying to come out of this, trying to tell. Those things run through my mind all day, every day. And every day it's a battle of, okay, no, that's not, you know, hearing Lori's voice, my husband's voice, my in-laws' voices louder than the words in my head that were told to me.
And imprinted on your psyche.
Yeah.
Like it's not just words on a page, folks. Let's make sure we understand this. Imprinted in all kind of horrendous ways.
Yep. The process of teaching a child not to tell is, like we said, part of every abuse story. I mean, every abuse survivor has that kind of imprinted on them, right? There's always that going on. And it makes it so that kids, you know, often don't come right out and tell. We've talked about the filing cabinet thing, right? As a kid, as a 12-year-old kid, I was incapable of taking the entire filing cabinet and trying to hand it to somebody. And so you take out files and you show them one thing at a time and it you know, it gets very messy and sticky. But then there's this also the competing things in my head, right? Even now, still, again, and even in recovery, I want help. But I also don't want to be in trouble. I want someone to see me, and I also don't want anyone to know. So the push-pull of that is super intense, which, again, if you're someone who wants to be a safe adult for a child that you are concerned about who is either being possibly sexually abused or is, you know, in a trafficking situation or has a family member that's hurting them, you need to know that that push-pull is real. So even if you make yourself a safe adult for them to share, it's going to take time. That push-pull, that conditioning, that is a very real and powerful thing.
And don't think you're being manipulated somehow if a child says one thing and then 2 days later they say something else.
Right. That's the push-pull. I want to help and I also don't want you to tell. I can distinctly remember so many times I would tell like a youth leader or, you know, somebody at church a piece of my story, a piece of what was going on. And then I would beg them, please don't tell anybody. Please don't tell anybody. Again, a safe adult would know how to handle that and would, or find out how to handle that correctly, to get the child help. But I know that push pull, I would verbalize that. Like, I'm telling you this, but please, for the love of God, do not tell anybody else because it's terrifying. It's terrifying. For victims specifically of CSEC, which again is the commercial sexual exploitation of children, the idea that someone would see, the really horrifying pictures and videos of what happened, is, sickening all on its own. I still to this day feel that way. I still feel like, yeah. That's all on its own, right? Because the disgusting feeling that comes with thinking about even those things being created and those things now having a lasting memory because there's a picture or a video of it somewhere out in the world, is horrifying. So, it just layers on top of all of this, all of the grooming, all of the conditioning. It layers another thing on top that's like, my God,
don't
if
look
I
over
tell.
There.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Don't look over there. If I tell, what if these people now find these pictures and oh my God, right?
And there's so much of a brainwashing message of they're going to look at these things and they're going to know that you did this, that right. you did this,
right?
Not that this was done to you.
Right. Right. Because that was the message, right? You did this. This is on you. Okay. So a lot of people, like we said in the beginning, have come to us and asked about a child in their life that they might be concerned about. So we want to talk about becoming a safe adult for a child who is maybe being abused. So for me, the thought of being seen or someone knowing, again, was that push-pull. I wanted it, but I also didn't want it. So it's, I think the treading lightly is really important.
Yeah.
I say that so reluctantly because the adult part of my brain and the mom part of my brain is like, you don't friggin' tread lightly. Like, you swoop in there and, like, make it happen. But the traumatized part of me and the part of me that remembers what it was like to be that kid knows that you need to tread lightly.
So the painful reality is that I have been in situations where I have every reason to believe that a child is being horribly hurt. And I have not always been able to get the child to tell me enough to help them be safe.
Yeah.
And that is that's a weight that we should all carry, right? We should all be aware that we have to at least do the best that we can. And it's horrendous, but we don't always have the power to swoop in, but we have to use what's in front of us to at least do our best.
Yeah.
Make yourself a safe adult. And sometimes being a safe adult, there isn't an absolute right or wrong. I mean, there are adults in your world who made themselves safe enough that you were able to tell. The teacher at CCA spent months spending mm-hmm. time with you. So there was an investment there, but she tripped up on the action part.
Yeah. We had this conversation with someone earlier today about if you saw a kid in a burning building, right? Everybody would like to think of themselves as like, oh my gosh, there's a kid in that burning building. I'm going to obviously run in and try and save this child. But too often what happens is that you see a kid in a burning building and instead of rushing in to help or figuring out what's the right thing to do to help, right? Because that's important. You overanalyze it. You look at the kid and say, is the building really on fire? Is it, you know, does that kid actually need help? Are they telling the truth? Are they really in pain? Right?
Maybe you should just hide.
Right. Exactly. And so as crazy of an analogy as that sounds, that's essentially what we're talking about here of knowing that a kid is maybe in danger. And that's what the teacher at CCA, right? Like knowing that that was going on and not taking action was essentially that.
Right.
Again, for me, another really important thing is being patient, right? Like you said, you have to show up, be consistent, be patient.
And that requires being able to, the adult to regulate themselves. Again, when I'm talking to a child that I, or frankly, an adult who I have reason to believe has a trauma story, I can't like walk in there like a bull in a china shop and try to make something happen before it's time.
Right.
You're taking away the power just like the offenders, right? You can't be in a position where you're trying to make someone do something they either don't want to do or they're not ready to do or they don't feel safe enough to do. You have to, it's got to be them.
Yep.
But you're making yourself safe by being patient and being present.
Right.
So hard. It's very hard.
It is a hard balance. Yeah. Okay. So survivors of this type of abuse, what is needed? So for me, consistency, definitely someone who will stick it out even when it gets hard and crazy. Lori will not share this with everybody, but she could share a lot of crazy, not crazy, like
not
that kind of crazy.
Yes. More just like a lot of intense emotions.
Yeah. A lot of like just absolute like freaking out that she's going to leave. Like, ridiculous. Like I can hear myself saying the words. I know that it's not true, but again, that conditioning is kicking in and it's like this like super immature part of me that's just absolutely hysterical.
So I feel like immature is too harsh. It's a part of you that was very strongly convinced that ultimately that was going to be the reality, that even when something good happened in your life, you were very convinced that it was only a matter of time. And so you have every reason to fear that based on your past experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Undoing the conditioning is really hard work on both ends. It's not just on the survivor, but also on the person kind of walking through that with them, whether that's your therapist or your friend or your spouse. Find a therapist.
All of the above. Yes. Yeah. Find a therapist, but
find a good licensed therapist. But even for just people walking through life with you, right? I mean, my husband can attest to the fact that I have very intense things happen sometimes where I know that it's coming from a place of conditioning. I know that now, 5.5 years into therapy, right? But it doesn't matter. It's there and it's happening and it is hard. So it's hard work on both ends.
Well, I think for the survivor, it also feels like at each next level of disclosure. So more safety has been achieved between the survivor and the person they're telling. And then the survivor is going to tell a next layer and there's terror all over again. Like, okay, this is where it all falls apart.
Yeah. There's always that feeling of it's going to be too gross. It's going to be too much. Again, that comes from a place of experience, right? There's too many people in the wake of my story that turned away because it really did become too much. It was too big. It was, you know, too much to handle. I mean, grace, right? Let's talk about that again. They came in, they tried, and it was not, they were so far outside of their league that they just ended up failing and doing more harm than good. A lot of people turn away because it's easier. It's easier to look away than it is to deal with the fact that this is real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, safety is another big one, right? Something that we have been trying to achieve.
We will not quit.
No, but it's an everyday reality. So especially a survivor coming out of familial trafficking where there was connection still to the family.
Which is very, very typical.
Very, very common, yeah. There is this need for safety. I mean, the survivors that I have been able to talk to and their stories that are very similar to mine, they all have experienced this level of getting threatened, of just this, they don't quit, you know? It doesn't ever, it'll take a break because, I mean, at this moment in time, I have there is no access to me. I am very, 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 very careful. And well guarded at this particular moment, but I don't know when there will be a way in, right? I don't know where there will be a crack in our system, and that scares me.
Can everybody just take a second and imagine what that's like to feel like you must be constantly on guard everywhere you go under every circumstance for something terrible to happen, and you don't have any sense of when that condition will change, or if it ever will. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Exhausting. It's mentally exhausting. It's exhausting too to feel like I just want to be, you know, I find myself sometimes being like, oh, for the love of God, I'm just going to run into Tops because I need these things and I'm not going to, like, I need to be a regular person. I have 3 kids at home and I'm trying to manage all the things and we need like a rotisserie chicken or whatever, you know? And then I literally like get out of my car and have this like freeze response and can't do it because I'm scared and I'm terrified. And I know that the reality is I probably should be terrified. So
you get back in your car and go home
and order Instacart. Thank the Lord for Instacart, you know.
Yes.
But safety, I mean, and honestly, again, having somebody who can walk through that safety with you. So again, find yourself a good therapist, but having friends and family around you who are helping you walk that out is really important, right? Because trying to do it by myself, I would have more moments of like, I just have to go in the store. Except that I know that Lori is a lot of times like, where are you? And my husband is like, where are you? Why are you not ordering your Instacart? My in-laws are constantly text us when you get home, you know? I mean, even you know, I went to a yoga class this morning and I had to say to my friend that I was meeting, like, hey, I got to meet you in the parking lot and I'm going to wait for you to get here and we're going to walk in together because it's not a good idea for me to take that chance. It sounds crazy, but this is the reality of separating yourself from this type of abuse and this type of trafficking. So having people around you that can be
help you figure out how to be safe.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Proper training. Go for it, Lori. Let's talk about proper training.
So in the same sense that commercial sexual exploitation of children is under addressed in the literature, it's under addressed in the clinical community as well. We're not talking very much about familial trafficking at all, and the level of training that is needed to help people to undo all of the grooming and all of the programming and the conditioning and the trauma, it's a pretty high level of training. And frankly, our mental health system at this point is seriously underwater. There's just not an, you know, certainly coming out of COVID, but even before COVID, the mental health of our community we're pretty vulnerable folks. So there's not a lot of resources available for people at this level of need. So yeah, we need to be doing more training of clinicians, and more clinicians need to be frankly prepared to wade into these deep waters to be able to show up for people with more complex stories.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important too for survivors to find those people to actively seek out. And I know that we've gotten a lot of questions about that. Like, hey, I need a good therapist. Do you have recommendations? Mm-hmm. And like you said, there's, you know, it's limited, but, don't let that be a barrier, you know, find somebody, reach out. We will try to help as much as we can. We will provide the resources that we have. And we will continue to try to cultivate that, I think. But yeah, it's so important.
It is.
I find myself just using like lots of words like that, like very, 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 you know, like, I don't know what's going on today.
How can we emphasize this adequately?
It's so important. And it's just.
Is it so important?
Lord. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay. I've been up way too early this morning. So
yoga.
Yeah.
Not even really yoga. It's more like a workout disguised as yoga.
Gosh, it was so intense. I did not expect that. It was great though. Okay. So, and then also just, yeah, someone to show up, you know, emotionally and physically, like we said, just being there, being consistent, whether that's, again, find a good therapist, but having people also just in the middle with you, people you can call in a crisis, is super important. You know, survivors need to know that they're not alone in this journey, and especially in the familial trafficking journey, it does feel very alone. And we're going to continue to talk about this point because we keep finding that the systems that are in place and the support systems that are in place in some of the anti-trafficking movements and in some of the organizations that are seeking to provide those resources, there's a lot of lack. There's a lot of holes to fill. And so it does feel very alone. I don't identify at all with what you would imagine when you think of the word trafficking, right? I don't identify with a girl that was homeless or a teenager that was addicted to drugs or a boyfriend that, you know, became my pimp. I don't identify with those survivors. And so it does feel like this really lonely road. So
I have been on a mission to, you can imagine, like, I'm trying to gobble up all of the information I possibly can out there about familial trafficking. And you can hardly find any. I mean, and what you can find is often either out like years and years, years old, or it's from a different country, or it's much more targeted toward more of the stereotypic trafficking population. So as a clinician, it's isolating as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense completely. So we are here as a support. If you have questions or want to ask us about a situation, whatever, be patient with us. We get a lot of messages every day. And, you know, some of them Lori has to answer, some of them I have to answer. So be patient with us. But we are wanting to, we like those messages that are like, hey, I'm concerned about this child. What do I do? Hopefully this gives you a place to start this episode. But yeah, definitely do something. Right. Don't just say, I don't know what to do, and throw your hands up and walk away. That's definitely not the right thing to do.
Right.
We have so many exciting things that are coming that we will talk about shortly, I guess, on our social medias.
Yeah.
Right?
Lots going on.
Lots going on. So yeah, stay tuned.
If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.